welcome back, and also thank you for being here if you're joining us for the first time. It's good to have you with us, and it's always an honor to be able to speak to you. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Ice Radio, based out of Sweden. Our website's redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com will get you much more. William Engdahl is our guest today. He's an award-winning geopolitical analyst, strategic risk consultant, author, professor, and lecturer. He has been researching and writing about the world political scene for more than 30 years. His various books on geopolitics, the interaction between international power politics, economics, and geography, have been translated into 14 foreign languages, from Chinese to French, from German to Japanese. Born in Minnesota, William Engdahl grew up in Texas. After earning a degree in politics from Princeton University and graduate study in comparative economics at Stockholm University, he worked as an economist and investigative freelance journalist in New York and Europe. William is with us today for our first hour to discuss the serious situation in Syria and the underlying reasons behind the expansion of the empire into yet another Middle Eastern country. Good evening, William. Thank you for coming on with us. We very much appreciate it. You have some great work behind you, some excellent books, of course. We're going to get into some of those today and many other topics. But first of all, welcome and thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Henry.
You bet. Now, the most urgent and pressing issue, of course, as we're talking right now, is of course, Syria, William. And I wanted to begin here and get your take on this before we get further into your other work and connected to, the, of course, the bigger geopolitical, kind of strata here, if you will. But tell us what your assessment of Syria is at this stage and what is happening. As far as I know, as we're doing this recording, basically there is proof, if you will, that's going to be presented to the UN, I guess, in terms of this chemical attack that has been talked about in Syria. But what is what do you make of it as you have been watching this on the media?
I've been following this extremely closely and in contact with friends who are in Beirut and Damascus in the last days. And this is, all the evidence points to the fact that the so-called rebels, the Al-Qaeda and other terrorists inside Syria, were provided chemical weapons by most likely the Saudis in order to create what's called in the intelligence business a false flag incident that would trigger the red line that Obama foolishly declared a year ago as a casus belli that dare not be crossed by Bashar al-Assad's government, namely the use of chemical weapons in the conflict. So the idea that Assad would use chemical weapons, knowing that that is the red line, and knowing that Saudi Arabia is not just chomping at the bit, they're training Al-Qaeda, they're funneling arms into Syria through Jordan and through other channels, through Turkey, and that they are determined to topple the government because it's considered by the Saudis to be a pro-Iran government, and that's something they will not tolerate. So all the evidence points to the fact that if chemical weapons were indeed used, that they were used by the rebels, by the opposition, supported by the Saudis and others, to create this false flag incident. And there are journalists, Jordanian journalists, have been in the Houma area outside Damascus where the alleged attacks occurred, according to the Doctors Without Borders organization, and they reported from their medical contacts in various of the hospitals the people being admitted on that particular day with symptoms of chemical poisoning. But they said, we have no evidence who actually used such such chemical poisons. So the Jordanian journalists interviewed people in the villages, interviewed medical people in Arabic, of course, and what they reported back are the father of one rebel who was killed mishandling some of these poison gas canisters. The father said his son came to him and said that the Al-Qaeda had given their group these strange weapons and not really told them how to use them, and they They were very uncertain what you know, what that was all about, but that they came from the Saudis. So I think more and more the evidence points to the fact that this was a setup designed like the Gulf of Tonkin incident during the Vietnam War to provide a pretext to go to war.
Yeah. Is there any evidence at all pointing at this stage that no chemical weapons have been used at all, and this is all a kind of a wag the dog scenario unfolding here?
Well, there is this report from Doctors Without Borders, which itself is a not entirely neutral organization. It receives money from the U.S. and other governments. One of the sons of David Rockefeller up until last year was a member of the advisory board of Doctors Without Borders. So they are perhaps being used to create a legitimacy to the attack, to the allegations that Assad used these weapons on his own people. He would be the most insane person on earth to do that when the weapons inspector had UN weapons inspectors had just come into Syria 2 days before, and when he knew that this was the red line that would allow the international community to isolate and declare war on Syria. So it's just inconceivable that he would be that stupid.
Well, exactly.
So far.
Yeah, but I mean, if we follow the official narrative of U.S. and Western media overall, then why? What is the reasoning here? Why would Assad use this on his own people?
Well, I don't think he would. I think what the war had been turning for the last 5 months toward Assad and toward the government, that the population is sick of war. They realize that the alternative to Assad, however brutal he might be in holding on to power, that the alternative, Al-Qaeda, to be blunt, is far more unpredictable and far more dangerous. I've talked to journalists who've been in Syria all over during covering the war, journalists from Iran and other countries, and they give reports that these Al-Qaeda or these mercenaries, they're trained in Turkey or Jordan, and given $100 a day, which is a king's ransom for a poor Arab, unemployed Arab youth, and they're sent in with a Kalashnikov and $100 a day and told, go shoot up women and children to terrorize villages and then occupy those villages and threaten the people with being killed. Well, around December of last year, I was told by these journalists, the Assad government made a very bold decision on the recommendation of Iranian advisors who had experience with this to arm people in the villages, arm his own people, the so-called people who want to overthrow Assad, in order that they can keep peace in their villages. And it had a huge effect in creating confidence between the people and the Assad government. So that's when the war began actually to reverse against the insurgents, largely the terrorists who have been pouring in from Chechnya, pouring in from Libya, from Saudi Arabia, all over to create this jihad.
Yeah, we've seen the exact same strategy in Libya used, a couple of years ago now, pretty much. And we had, at that point, we had a pretty strong reaction from within, you know, the government, and there was, you know, certain spokespersons that were out, that were talking with RT and some other media outlets there, and basically saying that, you know, we're not doing this. It's not happening. We are the ones being attacked, you know, and yeah. It seems very similar in this scenario when it comes to Syria.
I think so. I think it's exactly the same template that was used with some modification. Qatar was taking the lead role up until very recently, and now Saudi Arabia, which has a rivalry with Qatar on a certain level. Saudis have stepped in with Prince Bandar, the intelligence chief in Saudi Arabia, who's so close to the Bush family, he has the nickname from George W. Bush is Bandar Bush. So he's the one calling the shots on this. He met with Putin about 4 weeks ago and allegedly offered Putin a deal if Putin would back off on Syria and approve a UN Security Council resolution from Russia that Saudi Arabia would guarantee certain gas interests of Russia in the Middle East with the South Stream pipeline and so forth. But if Putin didn't play ball, that the Sochi Winter Olympics in Russia would have a wave of terrorism that the Saudis would unleash. Keep in mind, Osama bin Laden was a Saudi national.
Yeah. So where were these statements made again? Just to reemphasize.
Well, these are reported from a four-hour meeting that Prince Bandar had 4 weeks ago in Moscow with Putin about Syria and about Egypt, the whole Middle East.
Wow. Yeah, it's very, very bizarre how this is, you know, allowed to continue and how the same kind of methodology is being used. And we've seen, of course, in the last few years, William, a tremendous change overall in many of the Arab countries and Northern Africa, you know, in Eastern Europe from the color revolutions. And I see this as just one continuing plan, if you will, one method, but with many different strategies depending on what nation they're investing in trying to go into. Well, give us a little bit of the bigger picture here. There's much more, of course, I want to ask about the details of Syria and everything else, but what is the bigger picture here and you know, the interest in the region, and why is it that one country after another seems to be taken over and a new government is basically put in place by the, you know, internationalists out there?
It's, let's be blunt, it's the Pentagon that's doing this. The Pentagon, the CIA, the U.S. State Department, and the entire apparatus of NATO. And the aim is, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, as Zbigniew Brzezinski said in his 1997 book, The Great Chess Game, or chessboard rather, meaning Eurasia, said that the countries of Eurasia, which includes Russia, it includes China, Kazakhstan, Iran, and everything in between, that space on the planet has the only capacity to be independent of the power of the United States, to economically develop. They have all the raw materials, they have the population, they have everything, the skilled manpower, and that's the only region on the planet, said Brzezinski, that could be a rival to the American sole superpower, and that, of course, the United States has to make sure that doesn't happen. Well, the emergence of China in the last 10 years, last 15 years, as an economic giant, the reemergence of Russia under Putin's, largely under Putin's tutelage over that same period since 1999, has created, and the reaction of both Russia and China to the events of the U.S. invading Iraq and Afghanistan in 2001, 2003 for Iraq, that convinced, I think, many leading people in China and Russia, and I've been often to both countries and talked to numerous people in both, that convinced them that the United States was absolutely determined to become the world empire, if you will, that as the Pentagon calls it, full spectrum dominance, to control everything, basically. So the militarization of the Middle East is a crucial part of that. The direct U.S. or NATO militarization of the Middle East and the oil reserves as a way to potentially choke off the oil supply pipelines to China and to the nations of Eurasia. Of course, Russia has oil and gas in great abundance, but they want to create frictions between Russia and China as well, divide and rule. So the revolutions, the so-called Arab Spring, and I'm working on a new book on this called America's Jihad, Wars in Defense of our Innocence is the undertitle.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is Washington, the CIA, the Pentagon have weaponized Islam in the form of Salafism, it's called, or the jihadi strain of Islam that came out of Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, fundamentalist Islam. They've weaponized that and are recruiting cadre in madrasas and schools all across Eurasia, in Turkey, all across the Middle East over the last 15 or so years since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And they're creating these cadre to make jihad, to make holy wars. And the effect of that, of course, is to create huge instabilities in Pakistan, in parts of China like Xinjiang province and Sichuan province on the west. And through that chaos and that disorder, prevent independent development of pipeline routes for gas and oil to China from Russia, from Kazakhstan, from other sources such as Iran.
So this is nothing that would be this task, if you will, this conflict, this, as others called it, clash of civilizations, this is nothing that would be fulfilled by the conflict between Islam, you know, and the West, you know, Europe and US included. Naturally, this is something that has to be instigated then.
Well, it goes back even before the CIA developed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the early 80s, late 1970s, to go against the Soviet Union and their government, their puppet government in Afghanistan. And they took people like Osama bin Laden and they developed a strain of Islam. They had a translation of the Quran made in the languages of the Afghanis, the various tribal languages. And according to various reports, the annotations of what the Quran, various Quran statements mean, the Quran itself is in many instances a very vague document. Sometimes it's even self-contradictory because the people who wrote it after the death of Muhammad in the 7th, 8th century, the people who wrote it over the next 200 years, as circumstances changed, they kind of softened or tempered certain passages. So it's a document that can be read in many different ways. So the footnotes or the interpretation of the Quran in many ways is more important than the Quran. And the interpretation is taught by these fundamentalist jihadist imams in these special schools that are supported by the CIA. So it's across Central Asia. It's highly, highly dangerous weaponization of religious hatred.
Yeah.
It's like a replay of the Crusades in reverse, where the West is actually creating the Islamic Crusade, counter-crusaders.
Fascinating. I mean, it's horrible, but it's fascinating. Why is it, do you think, that many of these people are willing to play ball, and why is it that they are not seeing through this fact that they're being used in a larger plot, do you think? Is it too difficult? These are a lot of young people, you said?
Well, these are a lot of young people. They're even handing out Qurans in German language on the streets of Frankfurt, where I live, and all around major cities of Germany. And they're handing them out to German kids who are unemployed. They're kind of without direction in their life. They come from a certain strata of society where they can easily get marginalized. And then they're wooed into these special religious schools run by a man who's very tightly connected with the CIA, named Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish imam, if you will, and he runs a worldwide network of these schools that are recruiting these kids, and then they send them off to Syria and different other places to get combat experience, and they play on all of the psychological vulnerabilities of young people.
So the West is using this, the religion. We can see the conflicts in Europe and in the U.S. kind of in the larger extent. But what do you think, William? What will happen if we consider the massive influx of Islamic immigration into Europe specifically? Are you saying that this is a scenario, a situation that has been designed, basically?
I think so. I think I in particular have been looking at Fethullah Gulen. He is one of the least understood figures of political Islam, or some people call it as Islamic fascism, because that's in fact what it is, where you just have total control over the lives of young people in these schools and so forth. But the Fethullah Gulen was hustled off to the United States with the help of several very leading figures of the CIA, including Graham E. Fuller, back in 1999, in exile from the Turkish military because he was accused of plotting against the institutions of the Turkish state. Well, shortly after that, a student of Fethullah Gulen's school movement named Recep Erdogan became prime minister. And the president of Turkey, also an Islamist student and follower of Gulen, became the president. So they have been systematically using that power to put Gulen disciples, cadre, into the police. They've been arresting generals and military leaders who have a tradition since Kemal Ataturk in the 1920s of being the guardians of the nation. You know, that's an up and down history, but by and large, they see themselves as the guardians of the nation against, you know, a subversion of Turkish institutions. Well, all the key generals have been put in prison by the Erdogan Gulen crowd, and were sentenced about 2.5 weeks ago in unbelievably punitive sentences for allegedly plotting a coup d'etat against the Muslim government of Erdogan. So, in other words, he's used that to get rid of all the potential opposition. The former head of Turkish intelligence, who wrote a book about exposing Gulen's takeover of these institutions, he was put in prison for that. Leading journalists, 104 of the most renowned Turkish journalists have been put in prison. Groups like Amnesty International have even protested, but to very little avail. So the Gulen movement is using their presence in Europe. They're very clever about it. They say, we're the good guys. We are taking kids off the street. We're creating football teams so they don't get into trouble and da 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 da. But in reality, what they're doing is selecting the best and the brightest of these young kids and then sending them off to be trained in Turkey and indoctrinated and later off to places like Syria or Libya or what will you. And that's a very dangerous development. They're also now, they've changed their tack and said, let's build our presence, let's build our schools inside Europe. Let's not see ourselves as Turkish visitors who are ultimately going back to our homeland. We're here in Europe. This is our home. So let's build our mosques and our Islamic schools here. And of course that creates friction with people who live in these countries when they refuse to, assimilate the culture of Denmark or Sweden or Germany or what will you.
Yeah.
It's a political movement that's highly, highly dangerous.
Well, indeed, exactly. So these are, you know, people like Gulen are kind of middlemen who are there to provide, be in the supply line, if you will, then of young people who are manipulated by this and the religious thought and everything else to be part of this manufactured conflict, basically.
Yeah, and so many young people it's almost like an aphrodisiac to be part of something powerful, to have an identity. And so these young kids handing out the Quran on the main street of Frankfurt, they're very well dressed, you know, orderly dressed and have a very well trimmed beard. And,
Yeah, to have a cause, to have a higher calling, to have a bigger purpose than yourself, you know, yeah, I mean, you can see the draw for a lot of people, I guess, in, you know, specifically in that situation that you described in Europe, where conditions are not the best and the, you know, you feel ruthless and everything else, there's nothing really there for you. But who would you say, again, ultimately, if we go back to who is responsible for bringing this in into, let's say, if we specifically look at the situation in Europe now, there is a willingness there, I think, from the part of both politicians, but also people maybe more behind the scenes that we're not accustomed to or don't have the names of. But I find it very interesting when people like Merkel, when people like, was it Cameron? And even after that, was another Prime Minister, Sarkozy, I think it was. They all basically went out at the same time back in 2010 and talked about how multiculturalism had failed and everything else. And there was like no kind of follow-up response to this. It was basically just to kind of deflate this whole bubble that they have kind of brought into and brought upon Europe. I just find it very bizarre and interesting. It's almost like they're encouraging people to see that it's a failure and it was a planned such. What do you make of it, William?
I'm not sure quite what to make of that statement by the three of them in 2010, but I think most of these governments have really given only faint attention to helping people to assimilate and learn the language and so forth. In Germany, it wasn't a requirement of working here as you know, in the steel industry and some of the heavy industries where Turkish foreign workers, guest workers, as they're called in Germany, have largely been employed. So then they bring their family. They have children who grow up here who feel neither fish nor fowl, neither Turk nor German, because they're not accepted by German society, except for a small minority that's university educated and so forth. And I have many friends, many Turkish friends who grew up in Germany. You know, so I have a good sense of this. But, you know, there's a kind of a inherent cultural racism in the society toward Turks in on the German side. So that builds frictions. And then you have parts of Berlin where it's really ugly in terms of ethnic and racial conflicts. You know, gangs beating up, German gangs beating up Turkish gangs beating up German gangs. And once you start that cycle, you know, there's no end to it.
Yeah. It's like a civil war is being created,
I can imagine it would be ultimately in the interest of certain intelligence services who might at some point want to unleash some of this to put the German government on the defensive if they tend to get too close to, let's say, Russia or China or even Iran. And distance themselves a little bit from Washington. So it's kind of a ticking time bomb that you have growing in these countries that can be, especially with Fethullah Gulen sitting there in Sailorsburg, Pennsylvania, in his gigantic mansion running this network in 120 different locations around the world, that he could give the signal through his command chain to really start some nasty protests in the streets of Berlin and other places in Europe.
Yeah, that's very interesting that he's in he's in Pennsylvania of all places. Why?
Yeah.
He was brought over then, and he's basically, as you perceive it, he's under the control of the Pentagon or.
Well, the CIA brought him in and gave him extraordinary visa status, even though he was wanted by the Turkish government.
Yeah.
And the U.S. nominally is an ally of the Turkish government, a member of NATO. So at that time, they went against that. So there's a network. A good friend of mine, Sybil Edmonds, is one of the most famous whistleblowers. She was a translator for the FBI during September 11, 2001. She's Turkish and Azeri by family background, and the FBI had no one who was fluent in Turkish to translate certain sensitive cables and so forth after 9/11, so that she got the job. And they kind of made a mistake when they hired her, because she happened to have a huge moral streak in her, one of the most courageous people I know. And she began translating memos that showed that there was a nest of traitors inside the FBI, as well as the U.S. government, and going up to the former U.S. ambassador to Istanbul, Ankara, rather, in Turkey, and people in Washington, like Richard Perle, one of the most notorious neoconservatives, and that this network was involved in facilitating narcotics flows internationally from Afghanistan through Turkish networks and whatnot, and onto the streets of the U.S. So this, if you scratch at this a little bit deeper, you find a whole apparatus of terrorism, of drug running, of murder, and weakening of the state in whatever country it's unleashed on. There are reports, for example, take Afghanistan with the heroin. Before the U.S. bombed the Taliban to smithereens in 2001, allegedly because they didn't release Osama bin Laden, the heroin production under the Taliban rule in Afghanistan had gone, according to UN Narcotics Agency reports, had gone virtually down to zero. And 4 years after the U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan, the same UN agency reported record crops of heroin right under the nose of U.S. Military.
Yeah.
And that's no accident. It's like the operations of Air America, the CIA in Vietnam during the 60s and early 70s to run heroin, you know, through the Mayo tribesmen and so forth into Europe. But the heroin has found its way into Iran, which shares a border with Afghanistan. It's found its way into Russia. There are 2 million Iranian youth, reportedly, according to the Iranian media, that are addicted to heroin from Afghanistan in recent years. And there's a huge heroin problem among unemployed Russian youth. So you can see the kind of pattern that's shaping up. And there are rumors, unverified, that Fethullah Gulen's finances are in part derived from facilitating these flows of heroin and other drugs into Europe, Russia, and China, and Iran.
Huh. Fascinating, William. So the bigger picture here, if we zoom out for a moment again, we can see then that the intelligence services of the U.S. is interested in creating a world full of conflict. And with these conflicts or threat of conflict, you can basically, you can blackmail people, politicians, nations, bigger areas, regions, what have you, whatever you have to do in order to keep and maintain control. That's how I see it anyway. There seems to be not maybe necessarily an interest in dominating a region, you know, for its purposes right now. This could be something that happens 10 years later. You have to basically have control of all these manufactured wars and conflict and everything else to have this. This is where you, how you kind of exuberate power, I guess, right? Or could, would you describe it in a, in another way of what the reasoning is behind this?
No, I think that's largely the case. I would add that the through the deliberate creation behind the scenes of conflicts like Libya and so forth, the justification is created for direct military bases in the Middle East, in Doha and Qatar, earlier in Saudi Arabia, but now in Iraq and all throughout Afghanistan. And these permanent military bases are the lily pads for the U.S. and NATO to potentially control or launch war against Russia and China if it comes to that, but certainly to keep any independent policy developments by. There's a triangle that I find very useful to give people an image. I call it the Iron Triangle of resistance to the Washington New World Order, or whatever term you want to use for it, globalization. And that is the Iron Triangle of Moscow, Beijing, and Tehran, or China, Russia, and Iran, forming a space that inherently is resisting the U.S. push to just take over everything and everyone on this planet after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the militarization of all these regions through creating these conflicts, and you justify NATO or U.S. military presence directly. Sometimes they farm it out to the French like they did in Libya, or the British, but it's basically a U.S. operation, that you're creating the basis to control any future opposition to a one-world superpower.
Yeah, and you would include China in this, despite the massive trade relations with the U.S., the alleged reports.
Absolutely.
That, yeah?
Well, absolutely. I've been to China something like 9 times in the last 5 years and talked with every variety imaginable of Chinese, from businessmen to politicians to former ministers to military people and university professors, you know, from politics and so forth. And they are acutely aware. In fact, I would say it began around the time of the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing, to realize that the United States government was behind the riots in Lhasa in Tibet, that the Dalai Lama organization instigated against the local Chinese merchants in Lhasa and other parts of Tibetan areas of China, in order to embarrass the Beijing government on the eve of the Olympics. And once they realized that, they began a huge internal debate about what the real nature of this friendly relationship between Washington and Beijing had been over the last 30 years, and came to the conclusion they want to use us and use our cheap labor for their multinational corporations and production, and now they want to penetrate our markets for selling American cars in China and so forth. But in the end, they have absolutely no interest in the respect for Chinese sovereignty and Chinese national interests. It's U.S. It's a U.S. agenda only.
Yeah, I see. Now, if we go back to Syria for a moment here and talk about them and what's going on there in the bigger picture, we can either look at this from, as you referenced earlier, Brzezinski's chessboard or the project for the new American century, for that matter, as well. Where in the plan, if you will, is Syria, and why is this a strategic and an important area? Is it just to maintain control? Is it to give greater security to Israel through U.S. Power? How do you see it?
I see it on several levels, actually, Henry. On one level, it's the fact that Syria is one of the closest allies of the Shia Iranian government in Tehran, and the Israelis are determined to cripple Iran in one way or another. They've been the leading force at agitating the U.S. Congress for these sanctions against the Iranian economy for the last several years. So for that reason, the Israelis want to weaken Syria. But there's also another level to the thing, and that is that Qatar shares the world's largest natural gas discovery in the waters of the Persian Gulf offshore Qatar that are directly opposite the same geological formation on the Iranian side of the Persian Gulf called the South Pars Field. And in 2009, Qatar, who's working with the British and Royal Dutch Shell and BP and so forth, to develop liquefied natural gas and to build up Qatar as the world's leading LNG exporter through these special tankers and so forth to Asia, Qatar approached al-Assad, the president of Syria, in 2009 and proposed a gas pipeline from Qatar that would go through Syria and through Turkey into Europe to tap into the huge European natural gas market and undercut the Russians' Gazprom. Well, Assad refused the offer from Qatar back in 2009, partly because Syria has traditionally, even going back before the end of the Cold War, been a close ally of Russia, and Gazprom and the Syrian government were cooperating quite well. So on that basis, he turned the Qatar offer down. And at that point, the emir of Qatar made Bashar al-Assad public enemy number one. So they began supporting the Muslim Brotherhood inside Syria. And then the real tipping of the scales took place in March of 2011. In March of 2011, Iran, Syria, and Iraq signed a three-nation agreement to build a gas pipeline from Iran's part of the Persian Gulf gas field, the South Pars field, through Iran, through Iraq, whose prime minister is a Shia Iraqi, and through Syria, through Syria's ports or through Lebanon, where Syria has good relations, to the European gas market as a direct competition to the Qatar project. Isn't it coincidental that within days of the signing of that contract, the so-called opposition, the Syrian Free Army opposition to Bashar al-Assad, exploded in lethal fighting against the government?
Yeah. Very.
So there's a pipeline geopolitical energy dimension to this whole Syrian crisis. there's a political dimension in terms of the geopolitics of the Middle East. And then if we add in the fact that in 2010, for the first time since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, the Israeli government discovered that they had huge offshore gas fields. One of them is called the Leviathan Field, in the waters midway between Cyprus and Israel, and began developing that gas so Israel would become a direct competitor to that Iranian pipeline as well for gas exports to Europe. So you've got combined and conflicting goals all over the place, but they all point to the direction Assad must go, and we have to get our people in there, the Muslim Brotherhood.
And how would that, okay, so that would help to basically, would it help to, this is the weird point here, of course, where a lot of people think, okay, well, okay, so get the Muslim Brotherhood in there because that will help the you know, the kind of the trade and to get the pipelines and everything else. Or no, it's not going to do that, that you want to have the opposition to it so that you can funnel it through other means and other sources. Which one is it?
Well, the Saudis don't want the Muslim Brotherhood. That's they've been maneuvering to get their people in as president of the opposition council in Syria, which they did successfully on July 6th, I believe it was. There was a new election for the opposition council in Syria. And the Saudis got their person in who's not a Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis don't trust the Brotherhood. That's the reason that they backed the military against Morsi and the Brotherhood in Egypt recently.
I see.
They want a Saudi puppet calling the shots in Syria, just as they have a Saudi influence over the Jordanian government, and they want a Saudi influence over the Lebanese government. They had it with Habibi, who was assassinated, and they tried to blame that on the Syrians.
And the Saudis are channeling the U.S. kind of sentiments as well, correct?
Yes, the U.S. is, well, except for the fact that the U.S. is very deeply involved with the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Saudis don't want anything to do with the Brotherhood anymore. They don't trust them for very good reasons. The Saudi monarchy is afraid its own head might start rolling.
So there's a lot of internal conflicts as well here then, William. It's not very...
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge internal conflicts. Obama was completely flabbergasted when General Al-Sisi arrested Morsi and the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood and created what Washington does not dare to call a military coup, but in fact it was, to get the Brotherhood out of power in Egypt.
Yeah.
So that Obama has six advisors in the Obama administration in top positions who are members of the Muslim Brotherhood or close sympathizers. The State Department is very, very tied to the Brotherhood as a political card. That this is America's way to get puppet regimes to replace people like Mubarak, who had more and more their own agenda, even though they accepted American aid for decades. That Mubarak was opposed to many of U.S. policies in the Middle East since the Bush administration, since September 11th.
Yeah. So it's interesting to have relationships by, you know, being put in place and in power by the people that they later kind of, you know, turn against. And we've seen this, of course, with the, you know, Saddam Hussein and many other, you know, puppets as well, if you will, that has gone in place there. We're going to take a break in a little while here, William. I wanted to squeeze in one more question before we do so, though.
Okay.
A strike on Syria, how possible is that, do you think? Obama is allegedly seeking, you know, the approval of Congress right now to have a strike, basically. Where would this go, do you think? And if there is a you know, full-on strike here, how...
Well, I think the drums of war were being pounded by the Israelis and the Saudis massively up until Saturday of this past week when Obama made his speech announcing, to the surprise of most, that he was tossing the ball into the lap of the U.S. Congress. What that does, and that happened right after the British Parliament, to the surprise of Washington, voted against supporting a U.S. Military action in Syria. And that hit Cameron, the Prime Minister of England, and the people close to Washington inside Britain. But it was a major blow to this war push around Washington from the neoconservatives and others. Then no less than Donald Rumsfeld, the war hawk par excellence during the Bush administration, who orchestrated the disastrous war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Rumsfeld came out last week saying that the U.S. has no national interest worth going to war for in Syria. And that was after the so-called chemical attacks had taken place. So the longer that this is delayed, I think the better is the chance that opposition to the war will build, and hopefully it won't happen. God forbid if it does happen, because you have the potential for this thing to spread not only throughout the Middle East, but it could have horrendous consequences. So it would be one of the most lunatic actions of the United States government that they could carry out right now, to go to an act of war.
Yeah.
You would have the potential of Shia Muslims sleeper cells being activated in Saudi Arabian oil fields, being activated in Bahrain, being activated in many, many parts of the Middle East to simply create chaos and disruption. And as that spreads, it just has the potential to bring us, because of the involvement of Russia and China, potentially into World War III. So it's really not a very, you know, the talk of a few light surgical hits and knocking out a couple of chemical weapons depots of Syria, this is nonsense. And there are even reports that the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, has threatened Obama that he would resign if Obama gives the signal to go to war in protest.
Hmm. So they know they
have to come to that.
Well, exactly. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's they're playing with fire here, and I don't know if they fully understand what they have set up. But if they do, I mean, of course, then we have to think about what that means if they indeed are interested in creating these conflicts, because that speaks volumes about who is running this show, William. But we're going to continue to talk about this in much more in the second segment here. I do want to give out, obviously, your website. We want to mention some book titles. You have an upcoming conference in Denmark. You want to give out that website.
And it's called WilliamEngdahl.com, WILLIAMENGDAHL, one word, .com. And there you have all of my books. People can click on the covers and order them through directly through Amazon's daughter company, CreateSpace. That's one way I support my work, is through sale of my books and my works. And the other is the other article on the website you mentioned is all of my archived articles and YouTube interviews with various stations around the world. And that's accessible through WilliamEngdahl.com. So the easiest one to remember is WilliamEngdahl.com.
All right, very good. We're going to have that linked up, of course. And do check out some of his titles as well. He has some excellent titles there for you. Seeds of Destruction, of course, an excellent book. I hope we're going to get a chance to talk about that a little bit more in the second segment. But then most recently we have God of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century. Also A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics, and the New World Order from 2007. And then in 2009, William released Full Spectrum Dominance, Totalitarian Democracy in the New World Order. So some great titles for you guys there. Do check it out, WilliamEngdahl.com. And then also finally in Denmark here in September 20th to the 22nd, you guys are listening from around Scandinavia, Open Mind Conference. This year we're going to feature William Engdahl as well as one of the speakers. So he's going to be there. And the website where you can find out more about that is simply openmindconference.com. So if you do have a chance to go see William, do that, because I think it will be a good one, and check out some of the other speakers there as well. All right. Well, William, we'll take a short break here then. Stay with us. We'll be right there. And we are planning to continue with our part two of this discussion with William later this week. We had to cut our initial recording short today, and as I'm sure you can understand, we wanted to release this very pressing topic to you as soon as possible. But in our continuation, we want to discuss the larger GMO and food supply question with the politics of the global seed vault in the background, which all of these NGOs, charity and philanthropist organizations like the Rockefeller's Brothers Fund and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have contributed to, a very important and interesting topic. So keep your eye on the website for part two coming up. Later this week, you'll also be able to hear Joseph Atwill and Ryan Gilmore on the Covert Messiah. We also have a big roundtable on our past and our future. After this, Charles Eisenstein, Neil Sanders, and Anthony Peake, to name a few. Okay, all right. Well, thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have a good one. And remember that you can always find more on redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. My thanks to Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John, and we will talk to you in just a few.